The Clare Byrne Show on News Talk
with Aviva Insurance.
First in a new series on the programme next, where we meet interesting and inspiring people to hear their take on what made them. And I hope we're going to get some really fascinating insights into the moments that have changed and shaped lives and set people on a course that perhaps they did not expect to take. Well, for my first guest, I'm delighted to be joined by Irish barrister in London, specialising in human rights and civil liberties, and Ireland's Special Rapporteur for Child Protection, Keelan Gallagher. You're so welcome.
Thank you very much for
having
me. Lovely
to have you with us. Does this daunt you now, me asking you what made you?
Oh, yeah. I'm not quite sure what to expect. Yeah.
Well, look, I mean, what we're trying to do really is to find out how you got to where you got to. You know, what was the path that led you there? I mean, was law always on your agenda as you were growing up?
Kind of yes and no. So I suppose there were three things. I always really liked words. Like I liked writing and, you know, went to Betty Ann Norton theatre classes, you know, for a long time. So really liked kind of acting, writing, short stories, all of that. So kind of storytelling. I also had a rather nerdy hobby as a teenager with debating, including with Anton Savage, a presenter
here. Really?
Schools debating many years ago. So did that. And then I suppose the third kind of thing was I did definitely have a bit of a drive to want to do something that made a difference, just to, you know, when you leave this world, have left a footprint that makes the world a bit of a better place. And I suppose when you put all of those things together, kind of words and arguing and wanting to make a difference, the Venn diagram answer is probably something like what I've ended up doing.
Yeah, or you could have ended up in this chair. That would have been another option. Were you well supported? Because often there's one good teacher on the way through.
Yeah. So, yeah, I've had some really amazing support. I suppose I've had a lot of very brilliant women in my life. And it's one of those things where, you know, sometimes when you think about, is there a particular thing that inspired you or a particular person that inspired you? I don't have like an answer, which is like the one person where there was some road to Damascus moment where I was one thing and then I met this person and then the world was changed. But I do have come from a family of really incredible, strong women. And my mother, who gets called by my cousins, kind Auntie Ethna, kind of capital K-A-E. You know, all through growing up, she was a midwife and then she was primary school teacher in Darndale at Our Lady Immaculate Junior National School. And she spent her whole life just looking after other people. And she's now looking after my dad. And I suppose that's definitely something which I hope, can't imagine being at all as amazing as my mother, but I definitely take that with me. And I suppose the other thing is, when I was a law student, I read a book that was really eye-opening. So by someone who I admired from afar at the time, probably a bit stalker-like, Helena Kennedy, Baroness Helena Kennedy, human rights lawyer. And she wrote a book called Eve Was Framed. And it was all about the law being coded male and what the law did to women and how you could use the law better for women's rights. And I read that and I just found that was like scales falling away from my eyes. And kind of remarkably, I now work with her and she's a good friend.
You work with her now?
Yeah, I do. It's a real pinch myself moment, you know.
Have you told her? You've told her the story.
Quite a few times. I think I can almost feel her eyes rolling to heaven. But that's we're having this conversation.
I mean, you had that innate sense of wanting to do something for good, but that...
Yeah, I wasn't quite sure where it was.
Honed the path for you maybe at that time?
Yeah, I think that was definitely helpful. I definitely, when I went into law, you know, I was in UCD doing law in the 1990s and really felt I found my tribe. You know, I was surrounded by really amazing, brilliant, inspiring people and very daunting in lots of ways. But actually, I knew I just wanted to do something with the skills that I had to, you know, try to use law to make the world a bit of a better place. And it's one of those things where you are in a position where you're looking at these cases at the time in the 1990s when you're studying and thinking about how outrageous they are. And then decades later, I'm actually working with some of those people in the cases that I read about, which is kind of remarkable. Mm-hmm. Not quite sure how it's happened, but it has.
Would you say you've ended up where you wanted to be?
Yeah, I think that's right. But it's one of those things, isn't it, where I think when people look at your career path, they quite often probably think it all looks very logical. But of course, it looks logical when you're looking back. Whereas at the time, you're really just putting one foot in front of the other and just doing what you think is the right decision at the time. And it's somehow ended up being a bit of a meandering path, but one that I find really rewarding. Mm-hmm. I feel really lucky every day.
What cases can you look back on now and you say, I'm really proud of that one and that one? Which ones can you highlight for us?
I suppose human rights law is one of those jobs where there's kind of highlights and lowlights all the time. And, you know, some of the really obvious things are things like, you know, my client Maria Ressa won the Nobel Peace Prize a few years ago. Brilliant journalist from the Philippines. That was an amazing moment, you know, being with her in Oslo when she got the award for the work that she does for journalism and for democracy and for human rights in the world. She's an incredible person. Or in 2016, when we got the verdict in the Hillsborough inquest. I mean, they were really amazing moments. But I suppose one of the things that I really find rewarding and motivating is the quiet victories that no one ever hears about. So for many years, I did a lot of work in London working for street homeless kids and, you know, children who'd been victims of child sexual exploitation or neglect, had to leave their family home for whatever reason. And they were street homeless. And I was one of a small number of people who did the emergency duty judge applications late in the evening, where you telephone the judge and you explain why your child needs to be taken off the streets. And just a few months ago, reconnected with one of those kids who I last met when they were sleeping in a lift in Brixton. And they've now been to university, got a degree, you know, and they've really got their life together. And actually, they see that as being a real moment when it really changed them. So stuff like that, which is never in the headlines, makes a real difference.
And that person sounds like one of the lucky ones, because it often doesn't turn out that way.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you know, child poverty, child homelessness is something which is unfortunately a recurring problem. It's a problem here. It's a problem across the European Union. A real issue where there's a kind of mismatch between the principle of what we should be doing and in fact what's happening in practice.
I was talking to a lawyer who was working on a miscarriage of justice case in the UK recently, and they were asking me about similar examples here. And I was thinking, gosh, are we good at that here? Are we good at look backs? Are we good at examining what we've got right? What have we got wrong? Looking at cases where people might have been imprisoned and that might not been have been the right call. What do you think our record is like in that regard?
Yeah, so I mean, Ireland actually does pretty well, you know, in terms of human rights record compared to other countries. I mean, look, I've spent a number of years being based out of the UK, and the UK has a pretty shameful record in a whole range of ways in relation to human rights. And it's been a real privilege to work for the clients that I've worked for there. But it's been very interesting to be in the UK at a time when the UK in some ways became more and more regressive in a whole range of ways, including with Brexit, while at the same time Ireland was becoming more and more progressive.
Now, among the cases you've worked on that I know that you're particularly proud of are those where you have represented Irish people in Britain, where you live. And we know that there is a backstory there where people felt very disadvantaged and vulnerable when they lived and worked in the UK. Tell us about the Gravestone case.
Yeah, so I had the privilege of working for an incredible family of Margaret Keane. So Margaret Keane's a lady who left Athboy in the 1950s to go and make her home in England at a time when she was financially struggling. And she came over to Coventry. She was a dinner lady, real stalwart of the community there in Coventry. And she was very, very involved in the GAA as well in England. And her Irishness was so fundamentally important. And she was married to Bernie Keane, a GAA player. And the two of them were real pillars of the Irish community in Britain. And when Margaret died in 2018, it was very, very important to her family that the Irish language be on her gravestone, because it reflected her heritage and what she was all about. And they wanted to put on her gravestone the words, "In our gríthe go Joe," so in our hearts forever. Quite straightforward, you would think. But along came an ecclesiastical court judge in Coventry, the Chancellor of Coventry, who ruled that she was not allowed to have those words on the gravestone because of the unfortunate history of the Irish language. And he said, in an astonishingly anti-Irish and discriminatory ruling, he said that if people were walking through a graveyard in English-speaking Coventry and they saw the Irish language, they'd assume it was a political slogan, as if it was the equivalent of writing Chucky or Law or something on a gravestone. And really, that case united the Irish community in Britain. It was so outrageous. And I was instructed by the family. We ended up taking the case on appeal. We had to go, rather strangely, to do the hearing in a courtroom, which was in a court, in a church, with bow bells ringing in the background, you know, with the judges sitting up on an altar.
That was an experience I assume you've never had before, right?
But one and only, really, because actually very few cases go that far. And this was the first time this kind of case had gone that far in the ecclesiastical court system. And I'm pleased to say that the family won. And there was a finding that, in fact, what the decision had been anti-Irish and discriminatory. It's a really important case for the Irish in Britain. But also, Claire, it's really important, I think, that case about what we think about Irishness here in Ireland, because quite a lot of people said to me when they heard my clients talking about how important their Irish identity was to them, when they heard them talking about that with their English accents, with their Coventry accents, you know, it made a lot of people think that when I was growing up in the 1980s, it's the kind of thing people would call plastic Paddy, for example. And actually people, it made people think twice about what Irishness looks like, because Irishness comes with many different accents, many different colours, many different stripes. So I think it's also very important about the diaspora community of Irish people around the world.
Yeah, and I'm still thinking about that case. And the fact, was it the Church of England?
It was the Church of England,
who decided to defend that position taken by one man. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, so actually the Church of England itself, Church of England leadership was quite embarrassed about it, was the impression that we got.
Could they not have stopped it? I mean, they decided to take it all the way.
Yeah, so what actually ended up happening was, rather helpfully, the family initially, when they had to bring the appeal, had to also face really oppressive costs. So myself and my team were all acting for free in the case, acting pro bono, because we felt very strongly about the case and we wanted to help. But that wasn't enough, because they were also facing costs. And the family managed to get a change to the law, meaning, in fact, that there's cost protection in these kind of cases going forward. So not only do they get the right result for them, they've also got a change to the law which helps other people.
Now, had you not pursued a career in law, what would you be doing?
Oh, gosh, probably, well, not sitting in your chair, probably writing not very well. Not sure who'd be reading it. Yeah, and I think there's some jobs that you don't really think about when you're a kid. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not really on your radar. I now look with real admiration at some other jobs that I didn't really think about when I was much younger. So, I mean, journalism, diplomacy. I work with diplomats and journalists all the time, hugely impressed by what they do. And there are probably things where if I was thinking again, knowing what I know now, maybe I'd think about those as alternative options too.
Well, we're glad that you're doing what you're doing and you're learning to fly as well.
I am indeed.
Thank you so much, Keelan, for coming in. Lovely to see you and for telling us what made you. We'll have more in that series as we go along. My thanks to all of you for listening today and for getting in touch with us on the show. If you've missed anything, you can catch up on newstalk.com or on the Newstalk app, which is powered by Go Loud. The team today, Cormac McDonough on sound, producers Dee King, Helena O'Toole and Alex Russo, with research by David O'Connor. Our broadcast assistant is Anne-Marie Kane. Andrea Gilligan is next. I'll be back tomorrow at 9 o'clock on Newstalk.
The Claire Byrne Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekday mornings at 9 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.